Okay, so for the next part, but I would just explain a little bit about bowing practice. And probably the one I think most people that come to the monastery have sort of the most resistance to. Not so much to chanting or meditation, but I think it's the, you know, it's just not something in say, American culture anyway, something that we do too much. Or, you know, definitely, I don't think I'd ever seen it being done until I actually got to the monastery, sort of bowing. You know, but I grew up in the Methodist church, and, you know, lighting a candle was about as much sort of devotion as we sort of saw happening. So, yeah, something that's not really understood. Just, I didn't have any aversion to it at all. I think once, I guess my kind of attitude was, well, if that's what I have to do to be lived in monastery, okay, I'll do it, no problem. And didn't really question it too much. And I think because of that, I had some pretty lazy or sloppy sort of attitude towards bowing, and I kind of got called on it a few times for just not really sort of going through the form properly and things like that, doing it beautifully. So I've taken a little bit more effort into it now. And so, kind of one funny story about it, that John Preston and I were living in New Zealand and at a monastery there, and there were two young men that were there as a sort of caretakers helping out, and both of them were sort of, they weren't Buddhist, and they were interested, they were there to study and to learn and to lift out, but it's like a couple of times a week we would get together and do the chanting and just do like we did earlier. And the two of them would just, you know, just sit there sort of watching everybody else as they bowed and things. And they felt really uncomfortable with that. And then we had a discussion about it. And then, you know, pointed out that it's something you don't understand, you don't want to do, that's fine. You know, it's not, you know, something forced on you or you need to have to do. But if you know sometimes if you're the only one in a group not doing something, everybody else is, you know, and sometimes 10 days while I just do it just so I don't have to feel uncomfortable. And so I was actually kind of impressed with the two, that they didn't feel like they had to do it just to conform. And then one of them had to leave about halfway through his stay, and family problems. And then in the meantime, the other guy started feeling comfortable with it. He started bowing, and he's like really joyful. And like, oh, I love this. This is great. He was like, I can't believe my resistance. He was preventing me from doing something like this. And then just at the end of his day, the other man came back, and we did our puja, and you know, everybody starts to bow, and all of a sudden we hear from the back of the room, traitor. Making fun of the other guy for having bowed. What you do to him? So it's kind of nice to have a playful attitude with it as well. But I think when I do look at say bowing, it's sort of you can do it to sort of say perfunctory, to sort of, you know, one, two, three, and then sit down and, you know, sort of not really, you know, just going through the motions and sort of not having any sort of hard feeling to it, and just going along with something because that's what everybody else is doing. But you know, so the real sort of attitude of it is just sort of you know, as the qualities of, you know, thinking of the qualities of the Buddha, just sort of being awake, being compassionate, being serene, things like that. These are qualities that we value and put confidence and trust in. And so just honoring that. So a lot of the bowing is just acknowledging. There's an, you know, appreciation, the gratitude that the Buddha and all the other generations since the Buddha have kept these traditions alive, kept these teachings alive. So it's just sort of out of respect, out of veneration, bowing to that. And there's also the physical aspect of bowing, sort of, you know, lowering yourself, bringing your head down to the ground, that act of humility. So in terms of sort of the Buddhist practice of, you know, looking at non-self, this is there can be a lot of resistance to it. And so it's good to as you do that, sort of, well, why is that? You know, where does that attitude come from? Or, you know, to sort of also looking at a permanence of the community first start, it might be something that is aversion towards, and then with our friend in New Zealand, it's like after a short while, it's like, you know, the exact same action before was bringing up aversion, and then just bringing up, you know, a lot of joy, and then embarrassment when his friend called him a traitor. So it's like the same act, you know, can bring up all these different emotions under different circumstances and different circumstances. So, yeah, good bowing, just to watch what the attitude is, watch what the feelings are. There are, say, different times and different ways to bow. So, like I mentioned, this is where we're leaving. So usually the etiquette in a monastery would be anytime you entered into a room where there's a Buddha image, especially where you're going to be practicing. So, like most places have like a Buddha image in a kitchen, if you're in a retreat center and things like that, or you know, if you go into a library, there might be a Buddha image there. And some people, I see in the monastery, you always take the approach that I haven't really seen anybody get down and bow in our kitchen, but we do have a sewing room, places in the monastery where you can go and be quiet, and people go in and do bow into those. Even if they're going into work or something like that, they'll still bow. But that's really, really beautiful. But especially, I would say, like someplace like in your house, when you come back to your shrine room, you're going in there, especially if you're going and spending any amount of time. So it's like a typical day in Waitakere, where I live, would be as soon as I wake up in the morning, get up, bow three times to my shrine, to the Buddha image, and then sort of get ready for morning puja, either doing stretching, getting my clothing ready, and whatever I'm going to need for the day. And that might take 10, 15 minutes or so. Then right before I leave, I'll bow three more times to the Buddha, sort of slowing down. That's the other aspect of sort of bowing practice. It sort of allows you these really nice, clean sort of transitions from doing one thing and then going into another room. As soon as you come in, so it's just stopping instead of just running off to do what you were going to do in that room, was just talking, setting a thing down, quietly bowing three times, you know, sort of making your intentions clear. That's like your whatever reason you came into the room, just doing that mindfully and skillfully. And then, so bow three times to the Buddha image, I leave, you walk down to the meditation hall. So get down. And then when I enter into the meditation hall, bow three more times, and I would sit and wait for the whole community to be there, and the senior monks come, and we do the puja. And so there's, in the very beginning, we bow three times, and there's all the bowing during the chanting. And then at the end of the puja in the morning, we do a, when the chant, I think you do here quite frequently, like the chanting of the divine abidings, or the sharing of merit, or some sort of recollection of the five recollections, and some sort of recollection chant, and sort of, you know, just remind people for the day to sort of maybe have a theme to meditate on. And then we actually bow to the senior monk, or you know, senior person in the community. And so it's interesting that when we do that, so if I was a senior monastic in the community, and the community is bowing, they're bowing to me. And so they're actually not bowing to me, even though it's like I'm the one sitting there. They're actually bowing to the monastic robes. So it's sort of the robe itself we think of as sort of a direct line to the Buddha. So it's like we're more sort of bowing to just the lineage, to the continuation of the training. So we're bowing to the more towards the symbol of the monk and the nun than we are to the individual. We might have respect and veneration for the senior monk or the teacher and nun, but it's more we're bowing to an individual. Even if there's several people here who actually like bowing, and since I've been here, there's been three or four people who when they see me bow, they could bow. And, you know, I don't take that personally. I don't think, ooh, ooh, ooh. You know, you know, I know that they're paying respects to the Sangha. My duty actually when someone's doing that is actually to feel joy. And to feel joy that there are beings in the world who have respect for that and that honor that. And so that's my duty, is to feel mudita, that the other person's good fortune, want to be able to do that. So to see someone, that's like a misunderstanding a lot of times. Who they think they are, want people to bow to them. Not that, to the monastic order. So then we would bow three times to the senior monastic at the monastery, and then we bow three more times when we to the shrine and leave, and then. And then, like after that, we have a half-hour sort of cleaning chore period, and we go off and sit and we clean the shrine, and then we come back and have breakfast. And then anybody can go anywhere they want to, but I always go into the main shrine room because the abbot usually has a cup of coffee or something in the morning. So it's always a great time. I can go in if I have any questions about my meditation. Or most people don't go in there for some reason, so I kind of have them one-on-one, so I can ask them questions. But every time I come in and go out, I've bowed three times. So it's like, you just have two cups of tea, so I come in with one, bow three times, and I get up, bow three times, leave, come back in, I bow three more times. Then we have this meeting, at the end of the meeting, bow three more times, and leave. And then we go off through our work period, come back in for the meal, bow three times. When I first come in, since the meal's over, bow three times, then I leave. Then I go up to my cabin, bow three times, then I come into my cabin. And then you might sit for a while or read, and then go out and do some walking meditation about three more times before I leave the cabin, come back in about three more times. So my hips are in really good shape. All the bowing we do. Yeah.
My question is, when
did you
know
that,
I know in the monastic order, setting, there are times that you as a monk are supposed to bow as a form.
Yeah.
But it sounds to me also like there are times when you just want to practice bowing.
Yeah.
And you can do just a little bowing. And I mean, for myself, I'm not much for ritual forms in general, but I've noticed that sometimes like there's so much gratitude or something like that, and I just like, I don't know if you, but that sometimes it feels like,
So let me bow, or something. Let me do something that's like next step, and like a way to kind of let out that energy of gratitude. So is that like, is that the kind of thing that, I mean, how, what are some of the ways that you kind of determine, like, well, this is the time that I really want to practice this, you know, bowing? Yeah. So I would, you know, all the times that I was describing, and that's sort of like, that is actually the standard in the monastery. So it's like, you know, basically anytime you come in and out of our cabin, anytime you come in and out of the shrine room. We bow. So I think I counted one time. It's like, you know, if you consider the three bows as one bow, like 100 times, like you might bow in a day. Especially if you like sort of alternating sitting and walking, you're continually coming in and out of your cabin. And so, yeah, so it is a lot of bowing, and it can sort of just become one, two, three. You know, just doing it that. There's actually some power to even just doing it that way. Just sort of, it builds up this. The form, builds up. I was talking about the barbies, it's like this determination, it's like just having this sort of resolve, okay, I will do this practice, and then this patience. So you're building a sort of a strength of, kind of an attitude, one of this willing to stop and slow down and do things. So it has a positive quality there. It's just like, so instead of like first describing, just adding a drop of water, to a barrel, like each time you bow, you're adding a drop of water, so eventually we'll fill up, and it will have the positive effects, and it's the same with say meditation. So it's like we have busy lives and things like that, so it's really important, I think, every day to sit down and meditate, even if it's only for 5 minutes. Because it's that continuity. So like at the end of the end of the year, you think, well, actually, every single day I have meditated. It was only 5 minutes, but you know, I did do it. And it just builds this confidence and sort of, you know, in a positive way, a positive self-esteem. And sort of, you know, okay, I can do that. I've made a determination. I can do that. So it has that sort of effect. But then also, you know, there is the quality of, you know, feeling this real sense of gratitude. And you know, I don't know, for some people, like the act of bowing might actually bring that up and things like that. I've never myself actually found that the act itself does. For me, it's more reflecting. So like if I'm reflecting on, you know, actually bringing up sort of like with my teachers, sort of, you know, seeing him do something that's really inspiring, and that brings up the gratitude, and then it's easier to bow, you know, when I'm feeling that gratitude. One thing was sort of like when I do have some loss of energy in my practice, and that, the main way I've felt or has helped me the most to deal with that is to sort of shift the focus to all beings everywhere instead of my own individual. I'm sitting in a retreat, metta retreat, and I think it was Carol Wilson I was interviewing with, and in a group, and I told her, I said, I just feel like I'm going to explode. Really, I was just really, really happy, and she was sort of almost in bliss. That's the best way to describe it. And she said, just expand it. You know, like I was thinking it was so powerful, I just felt like I needed to crush it, you know, sort of suppress it. So, but that was probably making it more intense, because intensifying practice, intensifying the concentration was making it more powerful. But as soon as you said that, I'm like, oh yeah, it makes sense. But when you're spreading it, it's like you take that same energy and just try to fill a larger and larger space. You start off with the smallest, I would start off with the universe, but you just start off with everybody in this room, you know, and if you still feel there's too much energy in everybody in Minneapolis, and maybe think of people in St. Paul after that. You start with people in Minneapolis, and you can keep expanding and further and further. That makes sense. Yeah. The other thing with bowing is the form we do in Theravada Buddhism, especially the Thai forest tradition, it's pretty uniform all over Thailand. Sort of the bowing. That's one way of doing it. It's like how I've been doing it here. So it's just on the cushion. I saw what Tom doing sort of more of the Tibetan sort of, so the standing pull up. Can you do me a favor? Can you do a, should you do one? You do one set, yeah. So this is more of a, say, a Tibetan way of practicing, which is very beautiful. Beautiful way of doing it. The Theravadins, we have a kind of joke that we're the sparrows of the Buddhist world, so we have a much simpler version that we do. And we often go to the Abhayagiri monasteries. We were given about half of the land that we're on by a Chinese a monk from the city of 10,000 Buddhists, Mahayana. And the master there, he's passed away, but Master Hua. And he and Monk Borsamedo, senior Western monk in our tradition, just hit it off. They feel like they've been brothers and meditators and many past lives together. So they really clicked. And so when, right before Master Hua died, he gave the property that Abhayagiri is to us. They knew we were looking for a community, looking for a monastery. And so it's really nice. And Master Hua always had this vision or dream, sort of as part of his practice, was reuniting sort of the northern and the southern schools, the Theravada and Mahayana school, back together, sort of helping to bridge the gap. And so he gave this offering. So we often go to their monastery to go to ceremonies and the pension or the religious holiday and things like that. And so they use the full body prostration and the whole thing. And doing it with our robes, like when they're always falling off. And, you know, our robes, the way we designed Mark them to be doing the standing prostration. So the way we do it in the Theravada tradition is we don't do it with microphones up to right here. Either so it's sort of standing, kneeling on the knees with our toes kind of curled up underneath us, and just having the hips squarely on the heels, and then facing the Buddha image. And then it actually depends on like sort of who you're bowing to. So if you're bowing to a monk or a nun, we bring the hands up to about the forehead. And one way my teacher talks about is that when you have your hands, this is called Anjali, so your hands are like this. But my teacher always has his hands open a little bit, kind of like this. And he always is thinking of it as he's holding a lotus flower. So he's like holding the flower, he's sort of holding it to his chest, to his heart, and he's sort of raising it up to his forehead, and then doing the bow. And so if we're bowing to a Buddhist, though, we raise the hand a little bit higher, more to the top of the forehead, and there. So the full motion. Number two, when we bow, it's like we try to keep the hips down. If you're not flexible enough, your hips try to go up. And the way I always be criticized for was my head would always go down to the fully down to the floor. So it's like, so we bring the forehead all down to the floor. And so we bow. Then we bring our hands up, have our elbows just a little bit to the outside and in front of our knees.
Okay, if people move, they can't see us. So please, if you
want to just stand and move, just call out bow to Mark. But there are commentaries that say that if a monk bows to a lay person, his head will split open. I'll bow to the coffee.
No, here we go.
There we go. Hold on. Watch Mark's head closely now. I'm doing that because my robe gets kind of slides off. If I was doing it and I didn't have it on, it's easier to do both of them at the same time.
In Thailand, I was trying to
think,
it might be for women, but for women,
you
can
put
the right hand on the left hand
and
the left hand on the
right hand. No, I've never heard that. I was doing the left hand for
sure.
Well, every time when I come up, I would go to here and then bring it up.
And here
and
start
here. Yeah. If you end there and then it would start. Then end. Go to the heart and there and then pull bow and come back to it. Does everybody want to try it?
Might want to make a point about the difference between
men
and women.
Yes, that's true too. Yeah, so for women, it's okay to just be sitting on the heels, have your feet flat on. I was going to ask the men who did the chanting earlier if you stayed on your toes the whole time. It's very painful.
During a retreat, I saw a young man,
Yeah, I've never.
Zen.
But it's a beautiful sort of, you know, gesture, sort of like, it's kind of the same thing, like we're holding the Buddha to be the highest, and sort of like, you know, honoring that sort of intention of sitting there. Is that what that meaning of it would be?
Yeah, I think the question that you're asking about. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yeah. Yeah, so I didn't start, you know, was raised as a Christian in a Baptist church. And, didn't be in a corner, so I was, you know, but, yeah, it just didn't feel alive for me, so anyway, the church that I was in, or it wasn't even, it didn't feel alive, it was, when I was growing up, it was like, religion was just not even part of my life. It was just sort of, I kind of resented the fact that I had to go to church on Sunday, and I'd rather be outside, and live kind of in the country, and just love being out in nature, and so I was like, that's where I sort of felt like my church was, even though I would have phrased it that way. So I was much more into nature, and so, it wasn't until, I won't get into this whole story, we only have about 45 minutes left, but the near-death experience that I had, you know, hiking in the Himalaya Mountains with Nepal, that had altitude sickness, and so that sort of got me seeking. And even at the beginning of that, it really wasn't, I didn't think of it as a spiritual journey, it was more, or maybe I thought it was a spiritual journey, but I wasn't looking for religion. And then, so initially I got involved with yoga and moved into an ashram in Massachusetts, the Kripalu Center. And that was the first time I really got devotional practices and the pujas and kirtans and, you know, the singing and the real full-on sort of, you know, devotional practices. And essentially I really loved it. It was something that my heart did sort of go out to especially the music and that sort of chanting. So it's really, you know, kind of high energy, and it would sort of put you into an altered state, you know, like kind of maybe a bit of raising your energy. And so I found that, I don't know if it was helpful, but I found it, you know, attractive to that. But I found it, if you hear from my talk on metta, sort of, I found it sort of having too much energy. Keep scratching.
Yeah, maybe just move it a little bit away.
Yeah.
You can actually bend it, don't worry about that.
Yeah, So I found like too much energy in my practice was a problem. And so like those kind of practices I think were good in the beginning because they, you know, kept me meditating, kept me, you know, doing the yoga practices and things like that. But at a certain point it was too much. It was kind of, you know, almost burning me out a little bit. So yeah, I found when I finally did discover Theravada Buddhism, it was sort of less magical or less sort of always really, you know, high energy. And so that, for my personality, was really good. So I do think, yeah, there are, you know, for each person's individual temperament, like, I still occasionally, you know, sort of, I don't actually listen to the Hindu chanting or anything like that, but there are certain times like my energy is really low, or, you know, sort of, you go through these peaks and valleys when you're sort of, you know, in any practice, I'm sure everybody here does as well, but sort of in a monastic setting when it's much more simple, it's like you notice the ups and downs, you know, so there have been times I thought it would be great if our chanting was just a little bit more sort of, you know, a couple of bells or something like that, you know, but I kind of appreciate the fact that it's not. It's actually teaching me to find that energy and resources in other aspects. And I think it's more, you start learning how to do that in relationships, how to do that with being in community and how to, you know, look out for each other and sort of taking care of each other instead of doing it in external forms. Somebody was asking me today, we have pets in the monastery and things like that. We have in a few of our branch monasteries, but what tends to happen is that the monastics are, start putting all their, they want to feel loving, they put it into the cap. You know, they start neglecting everybody else in the community. So it's like, it's easy to love cats, you know. And so we have to, you know, learn how to do that with each other. And then we tend not to have pets. Any other questions on bowing?
I have a very messed up
here.
So if I'm
doing
this, I have to
make more. So I'm thinking that if I have the right intention,
that
I can. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so if you're sitting in a chair, you have to do that. You can find a way to do that. Yeah. Even standing, just bowing. Yeah. If you had a teacher, you know, somebody, a person that you were sort of inspired by, and you felt like you wanted to bow to them or something like that, even though you're not bowing to them. Like, if you're bowing to Mark, he probably wouldn't let you. If you were doing that, it'd be best not to be, if you found him standing, you know, to stand over his knees and bow, stand back, or not to be taboo. It is interesting, like in Thai tradition, you always want to be lower than the monastic. Right now I'm using a little sitting cloth here and stuff like that. So in Thailand, it's like, even if it's just that much, it's sort of, they're really into sort of hierarchy and even physical, you know, higher, lower, things like that. And Sri Lanka, it's very customary for the monk who's sitting on the floor, and then the lay people come and they stand over them. Especially at the mealtime, they have all the food that they're giving to them, and they're just waiting for them to, you have a little bit of open in their bowl, lots of more food in their bowl, and they're just standing over them. You know, so for people who've trained in Thailand, when they're around Sri Lankans, it seems disrespectful. So it is interesting, like different cultures, you know, even though we're all Buddhists and we're all monastics, it's like just culturally the differences, there can be sort of misunderstandings in terms of, you know, that one person thinks they're being respectful, and the other person thinks they're being disrespectful. So that's why dialogue is really good. Yeah. And that's one thing that's interesting about say, practice in the United States right now, is that it's really one of the United States and Europe, sort of the first time, probably in the entire history of Buddhism, where all the different traditions are sort of together at one time. You know, they're like, Zen practitioners, and they've always been in Japan, Korea, Sri Lanka, Theravada has always been in Laos and Thailand and Cambodia. You know, it's very, very isolated, and different cultures and customs come up. So this is the first time they're all sort of in the same. How many monasteries or temples are there just in Minneapolis, St. Paul?
Well, quite a few. I'm guessing at least 10 to 15. You count all the different smaller ethnic Buddhist temples as well as
like my brother lives in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He said there are 7 Buddhist temples. The Buddhists have monastic living room, things like that. Just, you know, even in Indiana, take off.
Do you want to say something about Anjali, like how that's used and the feeling behind that?
Yeah. So that'd be like a shorter version of the full bowing, things like that. And so in the monastic form, it's anytime that the junior community member is talking to someone who's senior, they would hold their hand and call Anjali. It's probably the same thing as imagining a lotus. It's usually sort of just the whole hand pressed together, not the fingers spread, but holding it, just sort of in front of your heart. And it's just it's a sign of respect. So it depends, like in a very formal situation, like if say a bunch of monastics that are by here and we're going to go to visit another monastery where there's a very senior monk there, things like that. Like if any of our monks in our community were asking that particular teacher any questions, the formal way to do it would just be to sort of sitting like I am with my feet off to one side, and whenever I would be speaking to him, I'd have my hands in Anjali. Along with the conversations between me and him, if I'm asking a question, he's answering. You just have your hands in Anjali. and sometimes if it's a little less formal, you might sort of ask the question, you might start off that way, but then you just sort of put your hands down after a while, even though you're still in communication if you start off that way, and then if the senior monk sort of answers your questions or answers your questions, and at the end you say, okay, thank you, you know, I understand that. And so the very polite way of just showing respect and honoring. You might notice if you've ever been around monastics that we have all sorts of different rules and etiquette and things like that. And so when a monk or a nun has her hands in Anjali, it's for the monastic, we're supposed to do that for someone who's senior to us. And so oftentimes, I had this experience when I first came across some of the Western monks. I saw them coming and I was respectful and I put my hands in Anjali and I was expecting them to do the same back to me and they didn't. And I thought, boy, they're pretty arrogant. Why don't they acknowledge that or something like that? And they may have nodded or something like that or said hello, but they didn't put their hands in Anjali. I thought that was really weird. But it's actually, as our rule, it's against our rule to do it to anybody, not to a junior, it's okay for me to do it to a junior monk or nun, but to do it to a layperson is actually a minor offense. And, creating a hierarchy or just sort of, for lay people showing respect to the monastic community. It's not necessarily we're better, you're worse, or anything like that, but it's just setting up, sort of respecting the teachings, respecting the monastic sangha. So again, we don't do this in California, but this is called an asana, this bench that I'm sitting on. And so in almost all the monasteries, I think all the monasteries have been in Thailand, it'd actually be a little bit higher, maybe about the height of a chair, maybe even a little bit higher than that even. You know, like in the front wall or the side wall, it could be this raised platform, and that's where all the monastics would sit, and like people sit down below. And my teacher in California, Ajahn Pasana, doesn't like the asanas. You see with this, sort of the unwashed heathen down below, before the monastics appear up here. So he doesn't want to do that, and I kind of really respect that. Of course, Tomato once was invited by the Spirit Rock teachers to come and provide a week of training, teaching for the senior monks and all the senior teachers there. And they realized that, like all the years that they've been practicing together, they never actually sat together as a group. And so they invited, of course, Tomato to come. And of course, Tomato decided he was going to sit on the floor. He did sit at the front with all the monastics set up front. It was really beautiful because for the first day, of course, Mayo didn't say a word. He just sort of, the whole day, we came in and sat and meditated all afternoon, just meditating, no instructions. And finally, Jack Cornfield at the end of the day sort of said, "Lung Four, we've been sitting here all day, could you please give us some instructions?" And I was waiting to be asked. I didn't want to assume that I knew anything you didn't. And so it was really beautiful. And that's sort of the way most of the teachings are presented in a little chant that we do. You guys don't have an injury. Do you have an injury?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a chant that I probably shouldn't start teaching until Mark Chant. But he did give an introduction, so I thought
that. You could have waited a long time. page 25.
It's a really beautiful little chant. The Pali, starting a little bit of a stamp practice here. So that is Brahma Chaloka Dipati Sahampati Katanjali Adivaram Ayatata Santika Sata Paraja Kachatika Te Seidu Damam Hanukam Ivam Pacham. So it's the Brahma God Sahampati, Lord of the world, with palms joined in reverence, requested a favor. Beings are there with but little dust in their eyes. Pray, teach Dhamma, ask compassion for them. So this is part of the Buddhist story is that after he became enlightened, after spending I think it was four eons, which is basically a big bang to a big crunch, and maybe it's even like 1,000 of those. So it's just an incalculable period of time. Sort of after he made the determination to become the Buddha, he sort of finally on his night of enlightenment sort of just started reflecting on, you know, what it was that he had discovered, or what had happened that made him become a Buddha. And he said, oh, it's subtle. It wasn't like complicated or difficult in sort of, you know, taking a strong intellect to be able to figure it out. It was like you had to get a PhD or something like that, but it was too subtle. You know, people are we're driven by craving, and just that is a little bit of craving just is enough that we can't see it. It's just, no, you know, I can't teach it. I'm gonna, it'd be too much trouble for me. No one's gonna understand it, so I'm not gonna meditate, or not gonna teach this. And Ajahn Amaro sort of points out that it's kind of hard to believe that he spent four incalculable periods of time sort of developing this, and then he decides, I'm not gonna teach. But by legend, that's what happened. And then there was one of the highest, the Brahma realm. If you study the Buddhist cosmology, there's the, I think, 32 different realms of existence. Where do you think human realm is on there in terms of highest to lowest in the Buddhist cosmology? What's that? Yeah, we're near the bottom. So there's like, I think we're fifth, like the hell realm, the animal realm. One or two realms, but I think it's like four below us, and everything above us is like 27 realms higher than us, so it's more and more blissful. But they said that the human realm is the most auspicious to be born in, because we have an equal amount or sort of equal sort of proportion of suffering and pleasure. So it's the one realm where you can actually put forth effort, because if you're one realm lower, sort of like in an animal realm, there's too much survival. It's about survival instincts, and so it's hard to have the time and the energy to put forth into Dhamma practice. And then one higher realm, I think it's the celestial musicians. So they're all partying and playing their instruments and stuff like that. Even though the lowest, you know, so the heaven realms, but just partying, there's just partying all the time. So it's like, life's good. You know, I don't need to worry about the suffering. And so, also the Deva realms, their lifetimes are a lot longer than ours, so it's really, really difficult to see impermanence. It's kind of hard to... So anyway, so the human realm is the most auspicious, because it's the one realm where you actually can put forth the proper effort to understand the teachings. So what happened was, the Buddha had this thought, this Brahma god is in the highest realm, the physical realm of the... There's actually four realms higher than him, but those are non-returning realms. So in terms of, like, say, Buddhism, the enlightenment extreme, that's your once-returner, then non-returner. So if you become a non-returner, then you go up into one of these four highest heaven realms, and they last extremely long periods of time. But when you pass away from those realms, then you would be enlightened. And, so this god is at the fifth highest realm. Sort of, he's reading the Buddha's mind, he's sort of rejoicing that the Buddha's come into the world, and he understands the Buddha's not going to teach. And he thinks, oh, this is a great loss, the teachings are only come very rarely in the universe. And so he comes down, takes on the disguise of a young man, and comes and puts his hands on Shri, and then makes this request. And then the Buddha said that he sort of surveyed the world with his mind, and he realized as Dhampati had said here, that there are beings with little doubt in their eyes. You know, there are beings who, if, you know, instructed, will be able to understand. So then the Buddha realized, yes, that's true. And so then he decided to teach. And so we can all be grateful for that. And it's interesting, another monk friend of mine sort of pointed out that the significance of this is that when Dhampati came down to the heavenly realm. Like most people, like, we're always looking for beauty, we're always looking, you know, for things to inspire, and looking upwards. And so it's like the same with the god realm. It's like, you know, everybody sort of, you know, not looking down, they're not looking at the human realm, they're looking at beauty and things up in the heaven realm. So when the Humdinger came down, it actually sort of alerted all the other Deva realms and all these other realms that something special was happening down on the earth. And so as we came down, it focused everyone's attention. And then, so the Buddhist teachings, if you do read the suttas, they, you know, are references to other beings from other realms actually coming down and receiving teachings and actually becoming, I think there's a reference to them becoming enlightened or being stream enters and other realms. So it's kind of an interesting way of looking at it. You don't have to take any of that on, that's true. But it's one way of reflecting or thinking about it. Yeah. Well, if you read the suttas, there are situations where you know, I think if you have deep states of concentration, you actually can be able to develop the ability to talk to or see other beings in other realms. You know, so if you read the suttas, there's many instances where. Especially in the Vinaya rules, if you're studying the monks' rules, there's places like where like we're not allowed to cut trees or damage plant life. And so there's a story where a monk wanted to cut down a tree because he wanted to have a cabin there, and a deva came to him and he told him not to cut that tree down because that was her home. And the monk didn't pay attention. He was cutting the tree down, so it was before the rule had been made. And he was swinging the axe, and the deva had a baby, and she was holding it, and the monk injured the baby, and she got really angry, and she wanted to kill the monk, and the story goes that she realized that would be really bad for her karma, so she went to the Buddha and complained about this monk, and the Buddha actually had made the rule that you're not supposed to damage plant life, and because interaction with the deva. You can take that on face value, or you can. When he became the Buddha? Before Parinibbana? I can't claim to know the mind of a Buddha, so but when he was in his physical body, you know, there was the physical manifestation, you know, he was still an individual, still has, you know, personality. Like essentially if you read the suttas and you get to know Helmut Hecker, he has that book out, the Great Disciples of the Buddha, you know, you can go through and read about each of them, and you know, they all have completely different personalities, you know, it's like, and then when they become enlightened, it's not like they've come from sort of, you know, homogeneous, sort of, you know, one sort of personality, one trait. They still, you know, some of them are tricksters, some of them are extremely intelligent, some of them are real, like have strong energy and faith and that kind of, so they also have their same personalities. So but the Buddha, you know, when people would come to him and they want to venerate, you know, him personally, he didn't really sort of, he was like, you know, why do you want to pay respect to his body? It's falling apart, it's coarse, it's gross, and things like that. So it was more the, you know, the quality of the mind. And then, but, you know, so what happens to the Buddha, you know, after he dies, you know, that's one of the imponderables. The Buddha said it's not even worth. It's actually sort of a hindrance to sort of try to figure out sort of what happens to somebody anybody who's enlightened after they die. Because the image I like is the Buddha sort of says, it's like, so someone does ask him that, sort of like, I think it's like, you know, what happens to a Tathagata who's enlightened a Buddha after they pass away. And he says, well, what happens? When I blow this candle out, does the flame go north, south, east, or west? Which is exactly, it's like, you're asking a question that the reality doesn't exist. So there's not an answer to the question. So sometimes it's even posing a question will actually be able to pose a question you're supposing there is a reality. So asking, you know, what happens to the Buddha after he passes away, that's a question that doesn't have an answer. So it's like, when you ask the question, you're supposing there is a reality. It just doesn't apply. So it's good to try to figure that out. Will be more confusing to you. So the veneration we're paying, though, is to the reality, to the Dhamma. So actually the Buddha, a short while after he'd been enlightened, was reflecting that he missed something, that there wasn't anything that he had reverence for, that there wasn't any, it sounds kind of arrogant, it's sort of like he was surveying the world, like there was no other being in the universe, that was worthy of higher respect than the Buddha. Since he was the Buddha, like there was nobody he could sort of bow down to or have reverence to. And he felt that like kind of at a loss. And so he realized that the Dhamma was something that he could venerate. And so he actually would, I don't know if he actually physically bowed, but he could say that he had his devotion, his reverence was to the Dhamma. And even the Buddha recognized the power and the importance of the devotional. And for him wanting to have that quality. It is interesting, the Buddha does really have, if you read the suttas, does have the real human qualities and feelings. Maha Moggallana, Sariputta, the two chief disciples, if you read the commentaries and the Jataka stories, like they've been friends and companions in so many past lives and things, that they both passed away before the Buddha did. And so and so the Buddha at one point, he's sitting there, he's looking at the assembly, and there's still many great disciples that are still around, the Nanda's still around, and he tells the Nanda that, since Moggallana and Sariputta have passed away, it's like the Sangha is empty. So it's like, he's not sad, he's not, sort of crying or weeping, but, he just has this hollowness, sort of feeling of just he lost some loved ones. So I find that really touching, if he could express that, to the Sangha. We have about 15 minutes.
Just wanted to know on the page of the question of teaching, at the bottom that the meditation is talking about at the end of the teaching. When is that appropriate?
Just the sadhu.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when any sort of monastic, anybody, even Mark, anybody who shared the Dhamma, something, let's say in a formal situation where there's been a teaching, even if it's informal, but like what we were doing at Arrow River, this last week or 2 weeks ago, we had a little work retreat, and every evening I gave some reflections on the 10 perfections, the paramis. And so like at the end of that, in a formal situation, so there's the request of the Dhamma talk there, and then after the whoever is giving the talk, somebody would say, Handamayang Dhammakataya Sadhu Parang Dhamma Se, which is, let us express approval of this Dhamma teaching. And then everybody in the group in unison would say, Sadhu, 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 Anumodami, which means like well said, well spoken. It's like saying that three times. Well said, well said, well said. And Anumodami is sort of gives us a good way of saying that. We appreciate the offering.
It's not formalized, we get INF today.
In the monastery, we do it that way. So every time that someone is giving the talk, there'd be the request, and several people in the monastery have gotten together, and this sort of three tone chanting that we do here, it's made up. It's sort of like I think it was. Forget her name now, but one of the nuns at our monastery in England, she was a musician, and she came up with the three-tone sort of chanting. So in your reading of it, like you can see there's a little triangle underneath. So this is basically the monotone of the lead chanter. So that's one way to look at chanting too. It's also this practice of the community coming together and practicing in harmony. So the correct way to do it is to everybody, that's why there's the beginning part of the chanting, there's the, what was it, page 17? Yeah, so the very first part there would be like, so I was chanting, you know, to the Blessed One, and going down, and now let us chant the recollection of the Buddha, sort of resetting the tone. And then, you know, then when everybody else follows in, you know, Buddha and Mark, and then Mark says, you know, a good word, so whatever tone sort of Mark had set, hopefully be sort of the rest of the senior monk was doing, keep on the same tone, and everybody would come in on that same tone, and then the higher and lower, and then some of the words have like a elongated sort of a triangle, and that just means that you hold it for a little bit longer. Sometimes even there's just a line underneath the word, and that means you hold it a little bit longer as well. So if you're reading this, there is actually in sort of like a musical score is on there. But this is a three tone. Many monasteries in Thailand have a five tone, you know, five tone, maybe even a seven tone. So it's much more sort of melodious and more sing song. So actually, whenever I do really feel like I want to listen to something that's more uplifting and things like that, I do listen to sort of the Thai chanting and the five tone. There's some really, you get some monasteries that specialize in chanting, and they can be really inspiring to listen to them and the energy. You know, also with chanting too, it's like, okay, I started with the yoga practices, which is sort of more sort of Hindu, and I was listening to, I think it was Bharidas, he's still teaching, you know, he's got some really beautiful chanting. I heard this interview with him, or I was reading something that says, and he was saying like in his early part of his practice, when he was practicing, all he was really taught to do was chant. And so he would just chant, maybe hours or something like that. And then he'd get into this sort of, you know, blissed out state. And then just sit like that, just sort of getting into the state where you've raised the energy and the mind. And you get into this sort of state of, you know, real happiness, and the mind is deeply concentrated. So that was his whole practice, is just, you know, bringing the energy up, getting into that state, and then you would sit in it for, you know, however long, 15 minutes, an hour, 5 hours. And as soon as he came out of that state, then he would just do the chanting again, bring the energy back up, and then to get into that state. So chanting can be used, you know, as a meditation technique or practice. And you do find, you know, particular types of chants that you allow you to do that. That can be, it probably be, you know, have to be sort of like in a long-term, you know, situation, if you're on a retreat or something. You know, it can happen off the two in the short term, but you know, part of the option of doing that, even living in India, this whole life is dedicated to that. So chanting can be used that way as well. And another way we use the chanting is actually just to learn the Buddha's teachings. So I agree with the recollections of the Buddha. But then if you look at page 9, this is every morning we chant this at a bike hearing. We either do this or do one of the sutta. And it's interesting, the whole time I've been in the monastery, I mean, we do sutta chanting. They call it the three cardinal chants, which is the Dhammacakka Sutta, the first sermon the Buddha gave. There's the fire sermon, which is the Buddha gave. And then there's the Anatta-Brahma Sutta, the not self. So those, and we, the whole time in the monastery, I've always done those in Pali. Even on the other side of the page, the English translation. And just recently, one of the monks in the monastery, and we started doing this reciting in English in the morning or in the afternoon. It's really powerful, just going through and just reading the translation of it. But usually, most mornings, we'll do the whole chant, which is the way back to page 5. But if you can sort of read through the, especially like when you get into page 10, sort of just, it's just sort of, like every day there's just this, you know, this this reminder, you know, birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha, dukkha is suffering, or sort of not, this feeling like something's not quite right. When we Ajahn Amaru always talks about that, it's like if you get the shopping cart at the grocery store that has the wheel that's sort of off-kilter, that's dukkha. It's not quite in harmony. So you know, although the associations I dislike is dukkha, separations and the like is dukkha, not attaining one's wishes is dukkha. And we go through basically the grasping mind is actually creating that, and sort of identification with the body, feeling, perception, mental formation, consciousness. And then it goes on, you also talked about impermanence of the body, feeling, mental formations, consciousness, and talks about not-self. So every morning we're just going through these aspects of Buddhist teachings. And so it's not only the chanting sort of to bring up inspiration, but it's just to learn the Buddhist teachings. And I like to be going back and forth between the English and the Pali, because then you can also start picking up the Pali language. And that can be helpful. We have about five. Do we need some time for any announcements or things?
Yeah. There's time for a few more comments or questions.
Is there anything from you, Mark, that you're hoping to cover?
Well, one thing you did mention is just the whole relationship with the road. I think that. I mean, it's just interesting historically that the roads haven't changed in your lineage, but also just because they're not as convenient as sort of regular lake boats, how you work with that, and maybe other requisites and other objects that the monks have, like what relationship you have to possession, might be nice just to touch on briefly.
Yeah. So, as a monastic, we're required to have seven pieces of seven items, and that's basically that's all that I really consider I own. I have a few other things that if someone were to take them or walk off with them, I'd probably be grateful to have fewer things to look after. We have three sets of robes. So I'm wearing, this is called the outer robe, or jiwang, is the Pali or Thai, and I'm wearing a lower robe, the waist down. And I have a third robe. It's the same size as this one. This is much larger. But this is one layer of cloth, but the other one is two layers of cloth. That's called the outer robe, or the sanggati is what that was called. So I have to have three robes. We have to have a belt to go around to tie this one on. It's a very embarrassing story of a monk who didn't have a belt, and he got embarrassed. So we have to have a belt. We have to have a water strainer so we don't inadvertently kill insects or anything that's living in the water. So we can actually use just the corner of our rope, even that's a filter, but we usually have a water filter. We have to have a razor for shaving our head, and we have to have a needle and thread. We have rules of sort of taking care of our robes. So if I get a cut in any of my robes or my cloth, I have basically one day to, before dawn the next day, I have to patch that up. And then if I don't, there's ways I can, I'll actually be in offense and I have to confess it. And so I get the rope back. But so basically we have to be able to take care of our own requisites. Oh, because there's also the ensemble. You have to have the ensemble. So the eight items. So with our robes, and we actually, in our tradition, we make these ourselves. So all the nuns and monks, we have to learn how to sew. So it's like one of the first things we do when we get to monasteries is take them up to the sewing machine and give them some cloth and show them how to feed the machine and things like that. So almost anything is this collar that I'm wearing, so I can also, we can wear more of this. We can own more than this stuff. So like underneath here, I've got another piece of cloth on, just to it became me warmer in the winter time, things that I can actually wear sweaters and all this sort of stuff. You maybe have noticed, if you've been around anybody from our tradition, we do have these jackets that just this color as well, that cover both arms. And we started to, in our tradition, wearing these jackets in England, and that's where it started. Because I started noticing, like in the wintertime, like people were wearing red sweaters and, you know, blue sweaters and stuff like that. And there was no uniformity to it. So you started wearing these big jackets, and you can wear whatever you want to underneath of it. It's your clothing. And but it's really, when we saw a set of these robes, I don't know if you can tell from where you're sitting, but there's these there's a particular pattern to it. So there's like a thin, there's like nine of these little these panels. So thin stripe here, the larger one here, thin one here, so it's like nine of these different patterns on the larger robe. And to sew all of these, it's quite complicated. To sew a complete set of robes, it takes anywhere from, say, 40 to 70 hours to sew them. And the one thing is, when you have to sew it, you learn to take care of it. So, like, if I lose this or destroy it somehow, I know it's going to take me a long time to sew a new one. Hey, I really take care of it, respect it, so it sets up that care. To the Alma school, like I mentioned, we don't have a Buddha image where we're going. We use that as a shrine, so it's like we're dependent on it. When I'm here in Minnesota, Mark's always been very generous and provides me with a meal or made sure one was provided. But if he didn't, I always had my Alma school. I can always just go out and start walking, and I've done that. I went down to Mississippi and just walked my own floor. And I don't think there's ever been a day that I've gone on altar and that I haven't found something, even in places like Mississippi. And Ajahn Chandoko is going to be here. Every year, since he's been in New Zealand, he goes off on Tudong for a month. And he's amazing that a few days where he hasn't eaten, a day or two. But when I went with him for a month, every day we got something to eat. So it's just kind of amazing. It seems like a miracle. But so that sort of is very, very central to our life. The almost will, which would actually keep us alive, the food offerings that are made to us.
People may not realize that you can't keep food overnight, so if you have to be fed every day.
Yeah, we can't store food, and we can't use money either. So we can't sort of buy anything, or it could be arranged that if somebody went to a store and said, okay, if Jody Paula or Ajahn Chandoko comes by here, I get an invitation to accept, to be able to get something from the store. There can be arrangements like that, but typically, we don't store food, we don't have money, so we're completely dependent. Oh yeah. That's usually the case. Yeah. We get too much, too many offerings. There's a great story where two of our nuns in England were going on Tudong, and I forget, maybe they were in Scotland or Ireland, and probably 99% of people didn't realize they were Buddhist nuns. They just thought they were Catholics or. As Ajahn Amaro tells the story, sort of like, they were walking through, and they'd say, so what denomination are you? And then they'd say, Buddhist, and they'd say, well, I'm not familiar with that one, but, it's like, it must be someplace there in the Catholic, down there, but okay, whatever. And so, I heard, the nuns were going through these villages, and, they only get, a quarter way through the town, they already have too much food. They'd have to sort of try to run out of town before they couldn't carry anymore and stuff like that. So people are very generous. So we try to we try to find some good use for the food and things like that. Try not to waste it and things like that. That's like I said, we just started a new hermitage up in White Sands in Washington, just outside of Portland, Oregon, about 45 minutes. And it is interesting there. The people want to be generous. They also sort of like, well, I'll give you food if you need it. But it's like, if you don't need it, there's other people I'd rather give the food to. It creates a sort of, it's like there's conditions on it. So it doesn't feel good sometimes. But generosity is always good, so it's never good to criticize it. But yes, we do recognize that, though, that, you know, that there are lots of people who are in need in the world and things like that, and you know, we are very, you know, supported very well through that. So it's learning to be content with little and not making too many requests. You know, just what you need, you know, so I don't, if I get lots of offers and things like that, you know, I could ask for all sorts of nice things, and I'm sure people give them to me, but it's not really being easy to support and easy to care for, so training for me as well. I wouldn't necessarily find it disrespectful, you know, because it's really their intention, so I think they're just seeing it as something unique and, you know, especially from a Western perspective, never seeing it, and, you know, something good might come from it, too. It's like they might show that photo to somebody and they'll be intrigued and inspired and stuff like that, so, you know, I guess, if you're in that situation where you see something like that, I guess that's, you know, thing is like, not to really be afraid of being around monastics, so it's like, most, especially in the West, Western monks, things like that, we know that it's not, it's kind of an alien tradition, and you know, that some of the things are, you know, people don't understand and don't feel comfortable actually sort of being around us and things like that. And so, even like when people come into the shrine and never been there, it's like very common for someone to sit down and you know, sit right in front of us and put their feet up, you know, pointing their feet right at the monastics or right at the Buddha image and stuff like that. And we don't say anything to them. After being in that sort of situation, I've been in the monasteries now for about 13, 14 years, and I see that it looks ugly to me. You know, this is the etiquette that we don't do. But I do have that perception now that that's not beautiful, more how I would phrase it. But it's just like, I know that person, you know, I would have done the same thing 15 years ago, so it's like, I feel like it's worse. Most of the monks that, I know, you know, feel like it's not good to sort of point it out because it's going to make them feel uncomfortable and things like that. So what happened in our monasteries in England was about half of the support came from Asians, Sri Lankan Thais mainly, and then the other half was Westerners. And then they had a retreat center that all the Westerners loved going to the retreat center. They wanted just to meditate and things like this. And then the Asians came because they wanted to make dhamma, they wanted to make offerings and be there for the ceremonies. And the two communities like never meshed. It's like they were one on one side. But just over the years, the two communities started talking to each other. And like the Asians were like, you know, well, why do you go to the meditation? Isn't it boring? Doesn't it make your mind go crazy? And things like, no. And they go, why do you do it? It makes us happy. It makes us peaceful. Really? Meditating makes you happy. So then the Asians started coming and started trying the meditation out. And then the Westerners were like, well, why do you come? I guess you never come to the meditation hall. So they're like, oh, we just like getting food. We like, you know, sort of being there for the chanting. Like, why? Makes you happy. Really? You think it makes you happy? Never thought of that. So the two started learning from each other, but like I would hear that like the monastics would never sort of like point out the etiquette that happened in the monastery. Maybe the Asians would do that. They would sort of be by the casino, like, Mark, you really should put the Dhamma books higher than the magazines, you know, put those on blogs and stuff like that. And so it's this really beautiful way of, you know, of how it was taught. So we tend to, you know, not even to get upset. I could see people doing that, but people will learn over time, things like that. So I guess my advice would be, like, you know, if you do, you want to be around monastics or want to, like, when the Chandak was coming, or if you want to go stay at a monastery or even visit some of the local temples here and things like that, yeah, don't feel intimidated, and, you know, just ask. It'd be easier to just sort of ask, you know, like you see someone who really looks like they know the temple, like, a lay person who's there, people are more than willing to sort of help you out. It might be a little different if you go to like an Asian temple where they don't speak English very well, or not used to Westerners. They will, you know, they might feel a little more awkward there. If you go to a place like Waiheri or Bible Society in West Virginia, there's quite a few sort of monasteries starting to form now. Ajahn Dick, do you know Ajahn Dick? He started a place in Virginia. So it's starting to be more. Tathati Lopez got a place near San Francisco. There's a nun monastery training place in California near where Waiheri is. One more. It's white salmon, which is, do you know the Washington, Oregon area at all?
I know
from here, it's basically just 40 minutes west. It's right up the Columbia River Gorge. You can see that right on the Hood River. The Hood River, Oregon, is just on the other side. So it's if you like outdoor sports, it's the outdoor sports capital of the world. It's got every sort of windsurfing. It's like the prime spot for windsurfing in the world. I didn't look on our website, but I think we probably, Waiheri's website. I'm not sure if you can get there from Fearless Mountain, which is another way of saying Waiheri, but the website that the monastery from out, the whole thing on books. If you go to the website, there's teachings and music audio and PDF books and things like that. And there is a book we have out called Rites and Rituals. And it does sort of go through all the different sort of etiquettes and things like that. But I bet just doing a Google search, just sort of, you know, proper respect around monastics, Buddhist monastics, you could probably find all that sort of stuff. Yeah, there's lots of real refinements and stuff like that. And one thing I'd say is, like, you say should, like, you know, you should come in like that. It's like, I don't like the word should. So it's like, it's more of a, yeah. One thing is, it's like respect. It's like, in Western culture, Ajahn Jeff, Mr. Rupika sort of points this out, and in Western culture, like almost how disrespectful you can be is a sign of intelligence. Sort of, you know, putting somebody down, you know, being sharp-witted, and, you know, sort of, you know, mocking somebody, that actually shows you how intelligent you are. But in Asian cultures, how respectful you can be actually shows how intelligent you are. And so it's an interesting thing. He gives this great example where a senior monk, I think it was Ajahn Lee, wanted the Buddha image moved from one side to another. Or I guess underneath the Buddha image, in Thailand, often underneath the image you'll have these sacred items buried in the ground. And it's like this huge concrete sort of thing. And Ajahn Lee wanted, they were going to move the Buddha image to the other side of the hall. And so he asked his disciples to, the monks to get the concrete box out and move it over there. But the senior monk who was responsible for it knew that there was no way they could do it. And so it's like in Western culture, you'd argue with the teacher. You'd say, well, you can't do it because of this, this, and this, and this. So this teacher, though, he decided, well, we'll do it. We'll try it. And so they spent 2 days trying to move it, and they couldn't move it because he knew they couldn't move it. And then so he came to him on the third day and said, why don't we do this? Why don't we build a new box over there? And then we'll take all the items out of that box and put it in that box. And the teacher's like, that's a great idea. But it showed respect. So it's like, you know, that's what the teacher asked to do. So we'll try it. It's impractical, but we'll try it. And so it was just this great example of, you know, showing respect and doing it. Where it's like, and I know if I was in a situation and I was asked to move that box, I would, no. You know, I don't want to waste two days of my life, you know, trying to move this box. It's more respectful to do it that way.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.